Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Welcome to Democracy Ideas, the podcast hosted by the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. My name is Alistair Scruton. Today, we will be discussing the challenges and opportunities for democracy in Latin America with the Secretary General of International Idea, Kevin Casas Zamora. Kevin knows the region well, both as a former Vice President of Costa Rica, Secretary for Political Affairs at the Organization of American States, a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute, and of course, in his current incarnation at International Idea. Welcome, Kevin.
Oh, thank you, Alistair. Wonderful to be here.
Let's really just try and kick off with the current news events that are dominating the headlines over the last few weeks. One has been the storming of Brazil's Supreme Court, its Congress and Parliament. And also, we've also seen a lot of headlines about the street protests and the heavy police crackdown leading to dozens of deaths in Peru. What do these two events say about democracy in Latin America? Do they have some kind of common thread to them? What is going on in Latin American democracy that these two events show?
Surely what these events show is that democracy is facing dangerous times in Latin America. And if we talk about common threats, I would say, first of all, that they show very clearly that acute social discontent is the sign of the times, as is polarization. Extraordinarily high levels of polarization, and we can go into the causes of that. And all of this made more acute by the dearth of institutional channels to manage such high levels of discontent and polarization. So inevitably what we are seeing in the absence of robust political parties, in the absence of credible representative institutions, what we're seeing is that social conflicts are making the way to the street. So I would say that for starters. Perhaps just add that what we are seeing is that after the pandemic, in the wake of the pandemic, rather than renegotiating their social contracts, what has been happening is that the region has been finding itself in a very dangerous and unhealthy equilibrium. An equilibrium defined by a very mediocre levels of economic growth, a very mediocre economic performance, and a very mediocre political performance as well. And in that equilibrium, the seeds of populist authoritarian discourses tend to fall in very fertile ground.
You mentioned polarization as one of the issues that tied those two events, both in Peru and in terms of Brazil. Why are we seeing this kind of polarization? The continent has had its economic lost decades in the past, so that's not so new. What's going on that we're seeing this level of polarization? I mean, you could argue that the kind of polarization we saw during the military regimes was even more extreme, right? But what is actually going on? You look at Brazil, you look at Peru. Peru had an election result of something like 52% against 48%. The lack of recognition of the government wanting early elections by the current protesters. The same thing in Brazil. This almost kind of hatred of the other side. We're seeing that in Europe. We're seeing that in the States. Why is it happening? It's not just about the economy, right?
No, it is not. I mean, there are general causes and there are specific causes. I mean, there are general trends that are taking place all over the world that are driving this rising levels of polarization. And inevitably, when you talk about this, you have to make reference to the role of social media and the role of disinformation campaigns that that feed into a kind of political frenzy where anybody who is not in agreement with you is seen as the enemy. That's a general trend all over the place, and this is a huge problem for democracy. But there are specific causes in Latin America that one can mention. I mean, inevitably, in the case of Latin America, you have to make reference to the still enormously high levels of socioeconomic inequality. That's always, you know, a driver of social conflict, which is it's always very close to the surface, and it's very easy to find triggers for social conflict in Latin America amidst those levels of inequality. Add to that the fact that social expectations have grown very rapidly in Latin America. I mean, one of the impacts, a positive impact that the process of democratic development of Latin America over the past 40 years has had, is that it's made the Latin American population much more conscious about their rights. So it is difficult for political systems, even in the best of circumstances, to keep up with those expectations. And in that, it is that gap that is growing every day between growing social expectations about access to fundamental rights, about levels of well-being on the one hand, and the ability of institutions, democratic institutions, to cater to those expectations, to satisfy those expectations, to grant effective access to those rights. It is in that gap that is growing every day, where monsters are breed, right? This is a general problem for democracy globally, but it's very visible in the case of Latin America. And finally, I would add that one of the sources of polarization that we are seeing in Latin America these days is one that we never really used to see before, which is the emergence of culture wars as a driver of political conflict. This is something that the region has imported from the U.S. and is particularly visible in the emergence of the religious right as a very relevant political actor all over Latin America. I mean, this has created a new cleavage in Latin American politics, which has become very visible in places like Brazil.
Could you give us an example a bit about how that works in concrete? For example, in likes of Brazil, this trend you're talking about, the culture wars.
Political debates in Latin America are not just about socioeconomic, kitchen table issues alone. I mean, now there's a new cleavage around issues such as abortion rights or gay rights that are creating a lot of tension and that are being used to mobilize it, not just around those issues, but around other issues. And I'll give you a very concrete example. I mean, when the plebiscite to approve or reject the peace accord in Colombia came along, you know, a number of years ago, one of the big mobilizing issues for the forces opposed to the peace agreement was to say falsely, to claim falsely, that the peace agreement had all sorts of deleterious effects in terms of granting new rights and new privileges to gay people. And that became a huge mobilizing tool for right-wing forces to oppose the peace agreement. So this is an issue that is festering, or is a set of issues that is festering all over the region, and has created yet another cleavage in a region, which has enough of them. You know, the as I mentioned, the levels of social inequality and economic inequality are more than enough to make for confrontational politics. And now we have an additional cleavage that is having a visible impact all over the region.
Looking, so 2023 will be probably the first year without the kind of pandemic in the front. This time last year we had Omicron. It's going to be the first, hopefully, clear year where the continent will move ahead. What are the main challenges that you see in 2023 in terms of democracy, in terms of elections, in terms of the economy? How do you think it's going to pan out?
I mean, I would go beyond 2023 and think a little bit about the next few years. I see the main risk in Latin America as that of being locked into a very unhealthy equilibrium, defined by mediocre economic performance, you know, where economic growth is rather low and inconstant, where countries have a very high level of public indebtedness that limits the possibility to address festering social issues and to meet social demands, where they have dismal levels of productivity, therefore making very difficult for the region to grow rapidly. And hence, making very likely that the region will find it very difficult to reduce levels of poverty and social exclusion. But that is compounded by an equally mediocre political performance. You know, countries, political systems that have a terrible representation crisis, where political parties are in a shambles, and where representative institutions are not really able to channel social conflict anymore, where there's a set of political perceptions strongly tinged by corruption, you know, real corruption, but also perceived corruption, and that is a big part of the current political climate in Costa Rica, and I'll go into the implications of that in a second, where you have a very visible inability of institutions to satisfy social needs. I mean, all that very unstable and unhealthy equilibrium is generating these chronic levels of political discontent that make it very likely that a certain kind of political leadership will emerge. I mean, in the absence of robust political parties, what you will see is the kind of messianic, populist leaders of an authoritarian bent that usually offer very simplistic solutions to very complicated problems. And that's a very problematic phenomenon, because populist discourses and populist leaders are almost by definition of an anti-institutional bent. I mean, they set out to destroy some of the key institutions that define the rule of law, some of the key institutions that are meant to check on the exercise of power, in ways that are inimical to some of the problems that are that the population is trying to solve by embracing populist leaders. And here is where I think a specific reflection is appropriate about the role of corruption in all this. I mean, the populist discourses and the populist leaders and the populist projects that we are seeing emerging in Latin America these days are for the most part rooted in the fact that population is fed up with corruption. It is a type of anti-corruption populism more than anything else. I mean, you see that in the case of, you know, the likes of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the likes of Bukele in El Salvador, the likes of Bolsonaro in Brazil. I mean, this perception that the established political parties are a bunch of corrupt, self-serving crooks and need to be pulverized. Of course, the problem is that the moment those populist projects start dismantling checks and balances, the moment they start going after the free press, the moment they start going against the possibility of civil society to organize itself and demand accountability. I mean, that's exactly what is counterindicated if you really care about corruption levels. That's exactly what you don't have to do. So we're trapped in this kind of vicious cycle whereby the fact that the population is fed up with corruption is leading them to embrace discourses that are inimical to solving the problems of corruption and of inequality in the region.
Martin Wolf wrote an article in the Financial Times just recently saying that the Western democracies, liberal democracies, need a kind of Roosevelt moment where you have a traditional politician from a traditional party offering a kind of new deal that actually gives the initiative to liberal democracy and overturn the kind of populist, more extremist movements that surfaced in the US in the 1920s and 30s. Why can't that happen in Latin America? Why can't traditional politicians take the initiative?
Well, I mean, the short answer is because traditional politicians are deeply discredited. I mean, and that's one of the things that are behind this acute levels of discontent. I tend to go about this in a different way. I mean, I don't think that is one leader that will, you know, all of a sudden, you know, will have an epiphany and will renew the fate of liberal democracy in Latin America. I think something beyond that is needed. I have greater faith in institutional processes of social dialogue, the likes of which are rare in Latin America. One of the problems of democracy in Latin America is the fact that we don't have institutional venues to have that sort of broad-based, wide-ranging social and political dialogue able to do what we have been mentioning for years now in a very vague and abstract way, able to renegotiate the social contract. I mean, we keep banging about this notion of renegotiating the social contract without never getting into the details of that. And part of the details of that are connected to the process to do that. I mean, I don't think that representative institutions in Latin America are up to the task at this point. We need something else. We need things like the social and economic councils that are part and parcel of political systems in Europe. We need different kinds of venues for a broader conversation to take place, one in which a fundamental agreements as to how to reform political systems and how to move Latin American societies towards more equitable outcomes are to be had.
How does Chile fit into that then with the constitutional discussions that, you know, have had a bit of a setback? That's an attempt, right, by a relatively, and it's also very much a generational thing. That you have a young leader there, a young president. What's going on there? Do you think there's something there to learn from?
I think the Chilean experience is commendable in the sense that when confronted by a very deep and serious social and political crisis, the Chileans opted for an institutional process to put an end to the crisis. That's not always the case. I mean, you could. I wish Peruvian political actors came to the same realization, or they had the conditions to come to the same realization that this kind of social discontent can be channeled through institutional means. The Chileans did, to their credit. But that's never an easy process. And, we can have a longer conversation as to what failed when it comes to the attempt to draft a new constitution in Chile. I think they're having a second crack at that. And I think I'm hopeful that this will work out better, because there's eagerness in Chile, to change the constitution. I mean, people were not willing to go along with the specific draft that was yielded by the constitutional convention, but the notion that a new constitution is needed is widely shared. So I'm hoping that this will go far. But it also shows the enormous resistance to change that there is in a country like Chile. You know, when you talk about renegotiating the social contract, well, you're talking about certain people having to give up certain things, and you are talking for sure, if we are serious about renegotiating the social contract and moving towards more equitable societies, you're thinking about transforming in a very fundamental way the fiscal reality of the region. You need to transform tax systems in the region, but you also need to hopefully reach a level of agreement as to the basic set of public goods and services that people are entitled to in society, and make sure that minimum that is compatible with human dignity and with equality of opportunity is provided for. I mean, that's the kind of agreement that societies need to reach, and the problem is obviously on the. I mean, reaching that sort of agreement is very complicated on the substance, but it's also very complicated on the process. I mean, what are we to have that conversation in a credible way at a moment when the traditional venues to have that conversation, parliaments and political parties and the like, are deeply discredited.
Moving on up to the storming in Brasilia showed what happens in the United States can actually have a viral impact in Latin America, specifically in Brazil. What do you think the role of the US is in fostering democracy, in fostering enthusiasm for new social contracts or new movements in Latin America? And do you think that China's looking upon Latin America as a kind of increasing opportunity for influence in the region?
I think the role of the U.S. at this point, I would say, and I would hope, is to do no harm, right? And by doing no harm, I mean, you know, try not to support the bad guys. You know, try not to support the guys that are trying to subvert democratic institutions. At this point, and this is true not only about Latin America, but in general, I think the U.S. has very little to teach to Latin America when it comes to democracy. I mean, they have to deal with their own crisis when it comes to democratic institutions, and it's a major one. So I don't think that they can exert any influence beyond not supporting the bad guys. I would hope. I mean, since we're talking about renegotiating social contracts and the like in Latin America, one thing I would hope the U.S., and I've long said this, including to my friends in Washington, D.C. when I was living there, I mean, in different institutions in the U.S. dealing with Latin America, I would hope the U.S., would help Latin America to upgrade their tax collection systems. You know, when you live in the U.S., you live in absolute fear of the IRS. You know, those guys are good when it comes to collecting taxes. Latin America is terrible when it comes to collecting taxes. I would hope that in a very practical way, you know, the U.S. would provide technical assistance in things like those that are instrumental to the process of shoring up democracy in the region. But in a broader way, I mean, I think it's limited what the U.S. can do at this point. For good or ill, the influence of the U.S. government, not necessarily of U.S. society, and that's a different kind of discussion. The influence of the U.S. government has decreased a lot in Latin America over the past generation or so. We can go into the causes of that. I think part of it is a natural process whereby Latin American countries and Latin American democracies have become more assertive in a kind of natural way. But it's also the fact, as I said, that U.S. democracy is in a terrible pickle. As to whether this has an impact on the role of China in the region, maybe. I mean, my strong impression is that China exerts a visible pull in the region when it comes to trade, when it comes to investment. Whether that translates into political influence is more debatable. It's more debatable. I mean, save for a few places, you know, like maybe Venezuela and I don't know, a few places. I don't see any evidence of that. I don't see any evidence of that. And so far, and this is very important, so far, China has been a relatively restrained in trying to exert too overt a political influence in an area that is perceived to be very close to the U.S. So whether that's going to change in the future remains to be seen. But so far, they've been very restrained. They have taken advantage of a few opportunities here and there, but there's not a major effort to bring countries into the Chinese orbit, as it were.
Starting moving a bit and ending on more of an optimistic note, you're from Costa Rica. You were recently visiting Uruguay. Both countries are seen as more or less lights in the dark, so to speak, within that region. What are the grounds for optimism in Latin America, and where are they? And do countries like Uruguay show that, you know, certain things are possible, certain yeah. you know, good developments are possible? And, yeah, and where in the region do you see those lights?
I mean, Uruguay is a case in point. I mean, Uruguay is arguably, even more than Costa Rica, I should say, Uruguay is perhaps the only country that you can credibly, about which you can credibly claim that they're doing well. They're doing really well when it comes to politics, when it comes to managing levels of social tension in a good way, in institutional ways. They're doing well. I mean, their political institutions are working the way they're supposed to. They have robust political parties, and that makes a very big difference. I mean, I keep coming back to this issue. They have the ability to forge a broad-based political agreements, you know, where different political parties converge. They have a lot of good things going for them. Good news about Latin American democracy are you know, few and far between, right? I would say that so far the robustness of elections in Latin America is for sure a very important asset that the region has. I mean, that's the area of a democracy where Latin America has made the greatest strides. Latin America holds elections and holds them well. And one of my big concerns at the moment is that it's precisely that area that in a way is facing some of the most stern challenges at the moment. I mean, you see countries like Brazil or Mexico, and very credible, very robust, very competent electoral authorities are coming under political fire. So, you know, but generally speaking, this is an area that where the region has something to boast about and has something to show for its troubles building democratic systems over the past generation. That's not enough, for sure. I mean, there are many other things that need to happen, and I would say that the single most important pending assignment for the region when it comes to building democratic systems is about the rule of law, which continues to be extraordinarily weak. You know, the ability to fight effectively against crime, the ability to fight effectively against corruption, the ability to fight in general against impunity, you know, and to grant effective access to justice, all these things are a huge pending assignment for the region. And the set of issues connected to improving the economic performance of the region, including raising dismal productivity levels, and the set of issues connected to improving the political performance of the region, including in a very prominent way how to upgrade the ability of representative institutions to function and to channel social conflict. I mean, it's a very big agenda, and until it is tackled in a systematic way, until we put democratic governance at the heart of public debates in the region, it's going to be very difficult. And I'm afraid the region will stay locked into this trap of mediocre economic performance and mediocre political performance, which leads directly to discontent, acute discontent, and populism.
Well, thanks very much, Kevin, for your time here. Very informative. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.